Hello, folks. This is Dr. William Curtis, and today we have a really special interview for you. Very pertinent to the COVID-19 situation going on where everybody's working remotely and stressed out and hunkering down given all the pandemic that's affecting our country. Today we have Dr. Sarah Perry. She's an assistant professor of management at the Hancomer School of Business at Baylor University. She is an expert in how employees and leaders experience stress at work, including, in particular, remote work settings. She's been consulted recently by the New York Times and other media outlets with regards to the broad rollout of remote work across the world in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. In addition to her research, Dr. Perry teaches in negotiation and conflict management and also human resource management and staffing. She also consults with organizations on topics related to organizational culture, leadership, and employee stress. She has a PhD in industrial organizational psychology from the University of Houston and a bachelor's of science from the University of Missouri in computer science. She spent several years in the high-tech industry before returning to graduate school to study the phenomena she observed in the everyday life of the world of work. Listen up, Sarah Perry is here to teach us about how and what to look for with remote work and how to deal with the stressors and changes that are in the near future for us. Welcome to the WFO Life Podcast. Buckle up for interviews, insights, and practical discussions, and the occasional intellectual oddity, all designed to help you master self, master craft, and accomplish any life mission. Hello, friends. This is Dr. William Curtis. I'm here with my co-host, Lieutenant Colonel Chris Story, and we are in the WFO Life Podcast bunker, so to speak, remotely working from Pennsylvania and Texas. And today we have a really special interview. We are interviewing Dr. Sarah Perry. And of course, as you heard in the bumper, she has a background and experience that are super, super important for what's going on in the world right now. We've got tons of people that are working remotely. In my own instance, I'm doing a lot of telemedicine. So we're now in a situation, it's like a brave new world where we are sort of exploring a new way to work and interact with each other. So with that brief intro, Dr. Perry, pleasure to have you on today. Welcome to the WFO Life Podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. So why don't you, everybody that we interview always has sort of windy road, you know, to where they got to where they are. And I read the highlights of your bio, but could you give us a little background, kind of your where you at and where you've been, where you're going?
Sure. So I started my career in computer science. I was a computer science major studying programming, coding, all those things, right before the 2000, the year of 2000, when no one knew what was going to happen when it turned to 2000. And so great job market, great potential in that field. But really, even early on in my college career, I knew I really didn't like programming. And so for some reason, I stuck it out. I ended up with a great job at Sun Microsystems in Austin, Texas, in sales. So I was doing pre-sales engineering. So I got to, use my technical knowledge, but I got to talk with people and be in a more interactive kind of job, which I loved. And that was my first exposure to a lot of remote work. So I spent about 4 years in the high-tech industry in Austin and in Houston. And it was really cool because as a new grad, even though we did go through the bubble burst, the whole e-commerce bubble bursting in 2001, especially right after 9/11, it got to be the worst. I got this great exposure to these expectations of being professional and being accountable and really given a lot of freedom to do what I needed to do to get my job done and to do it well. And I loved that. But then about in the third or fourth year after I had graduated and I was in the workforce, there were so many things I wanted to do, and I was working for a smaller company for a time. And I really thought, well, now I have influence to say some things about, or give some ideas at least for how can we do these things better. And I really got a lot of pushback about that. And of course, I was still pretty young and green at that point, but I had ideas and I wanted to explore them. And what it really turned into was a passion for research. So around that time, I found a grad school program, a PhD program at University of Houston in industrial organizational psychology. And that field is on the perfect, really, boundary of business and social science. So we get to apply science to the world of business and the world of work. And everything that you analyze in your work life, you get to study that in IO psychology. So that's how I ended up in this field. And ever since, I've been studying the topics of employee stress, employee health, and one specific area I've done a lot in is remote work.
Interesting. And of course, everyone is experiencing a little bit and a lot of that right now.
Yes.
With remote. When we were offline starting, I had mentioned to you that I'm a medical doctor. In our clinic, we have five physicians, five providers. And I was an early adopter of telemedicine work. And your background, it sounds like, of course, in the high tech industry, you guys were early adopters even before other fields, because you were working remotely, a lot of independent work, it sounds like. It's really, I think this is a really good topic to talk about right now, because I know for us, we went from seeing 15% telemedicine visits per week to 65% of our cases every day are telemedicine. So it's just for the patients and for the working humans in my office, it's becoming quite a interesting change. And I guess it's stressful. I find it, less stressful, but at the same time, there are certain things that make it a different situation for everyone.
Hmm. One thing I was thinking about, Doctor, was just that, we're talking about obviously remote work, or, some of us have been forced into more remote work, but I guess maybe as a baseline, are there a lot of differences? Like, what are traditional, recognized work stressors or organizational stressors, and how does that get better or worse with remote work?
Yeah, great question. One of the biggest stressors that's studied that's different with remote work is isolation. So people do worry about the remote work becoming too isolating. So there was a study around the mid 2006 timeframe, I think it was. Timothy Golden and his colleagues have studied this topic for a couple of decades now, and they found that there was a sweet spot of about 2 days of remote work is really ideal to have the optimum satisfaction. And so along with that, a lot of people have come behind that and studied why would we be most satisfied at, a kind of some amount, but not 100%. And a big thing is because of the isolation. So you miss the things that you typically have happen at work. Those really meet needs for you that help protect your well-being. And one of those is easy access to other people. And we all have a need to interact with others. And so when you're working from home alone, that often can translate into isolation, loneliness, and even depression and other physical, mental well-being issues down the road. One more thing as far as stressors is, and the isolation, what that brings along with that is access to resources, information, and anything else you need, physical technology maybe, to even do your job well. So you have to be set up well at home for that isolation not to backfire in terms of those things.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I, like when we were chatting before we started recording, I said I'd worked in back-to-back organizations that have a heavy telework presence, I guess you'd say. And one of the things that I thought was, pretty interesting on how that worked is, one, I guess certain personality types did better than others, you know, with telework. Like some people, when they were teleworking, they might as well be on vacation because it seemed like they weren't very productive. And other people seemed like they were more productive, you know. So I don't know. I'm assuming with your psychology background, that comes into play too. There probably are some people that just work better, you know, because they want the isolation, right? Or does it depend on maybe what the kind of work you're trying to do?
Yeah, definitely personality matters, and I think it matters in a few different ways. In terms of the productivity, you definitely have to be self-disciplined and a person that can manage yourself and your schedule proactively. So conscientiousness is the trait that we talk about in psychology that really captures that. Highly conscientious people tend to be very organized, planful, goal-oriented, and achievement-oriented. So they tend to plan ahead and be more self-disciplined. From the other side of it, though, not productivity but well-being, emotional stability seems to be the key. So the more emotional stability you have, the more you can be out on your own, and you need and enjoy that autonomy that researchers also say has to go along with remote work. But some of our research we published in 2018 found that those who have lower emotional stability actually suffer even when they're given more, or maybe especially when they're given more autonomy. So some people just really need more handholding or more resources. If you're going to put them out on their own, you really have to check in with them and make sure that they're doing okay. Some are
Dr. Perry, with your research, or with the research you mentioned in 2006, Timothy Golden's work, that 2 days a week was ideal. What were they measuring? Were they measuring just Was it some type of productivity score? Was it psychological profile? What were they actually measuring?
They were looking at satisfaction in that study. So overall job satisfaction. So that had to do with overall how you felt about the work you were doing, how your job was structured, your organization, all of those things kind of encapsulated into a job satisfaction measure.
You know, it's interesting. I have about 4 or 5 years ago, my entire, what you would call my front desk staff, the girls that answer phones for our medical practice, they're all completely virtual, including referral teams and all this. So if you were to call my office, the phone never rings in this office. It's always someone virtual that's doing that. And it was kind of, I tried to walk some of the, I had done some telemedicine work, so I tried to walk those staff members through, and it was interesting all the challenges that we ran into. I mean, some of them have kids, some of them have, you know, situations where they don't want to be at home. there's reasons they don't, you know, and sometimes when you just assign, you know, right now, like people are being assigned work, you must go home and work. Well, it's like, well, sometimes their environment at home, they've got social dynamics. I'm not saying my staff members are having these now, but just they have social dynamics and different things like that that aren't conducive to trying to do work at home. Plus, you mix the whole, I guess, the work and, you know, where does work end and where does time off work begin? How do you, what are all the angles in that lane of remote working?
Yes, and I'll also say that study found a sweet spot of 2 days. I personally agree with that for myself, but everyone's different, so that's an average. But I have talked to a lot of people that I've studied that have been participants in studies I've done, and the 100% remote workers seem to be the most set up. They're really well set up to do this, so they are a lot of them that I talk to are so satisfied. They really love. And most of them don't have the option to work in an office. So maybe it would be like your front desk workers, or it could be someone whose company is based in another state, but they are able to work for their spouse's career in a different city. And so they're really appreciative of that, and they've set it up so that it works for them. So the question might be, how do you make it work for you? So there are some guidelines I can share there.
Yeah. One of the things, and I'm not sure if this study or another study that you've looked at examined this point, but I know from my experience, you get to a certain level. Like I'm a lieutenant colonel, so it's like I'm not, you know, very low, but I'm not a general or an admiral, but I'm kind of like getting to the senior management level. So I interface with some, you know, pretty senior experienced civilians, and what I found was, even when they had the option, you know, on the senior civilian side, the higher you got up, they almost shied away from even wanting to take advantage of that telework, because it seemed like if you're in an executive level or if you're solving complex problems, there's like a push that you need to be there kind of in the mix, right? They had a harder time, you know, even, you know, taking advantage of the telework they were given, because they felt like when they were more stressed out when they were separate. So I'm assuming that there's probably some kind of, you know, look at that. Like if you're a senior executive, you know, it may be a little more challenging if you're solving complex problems with teams to try to be remotely separated.
Yeah, and you can think of that in terms of communication barriers. If you're at home trying to run meetings virtually all the time, and the richer the channels you can use for that, like video conferencing, that's great, and that can help with collaboration, innovation, complex problem decision-making, all that stuff. But you have to have all that and access to it, and you have to have working knowledge of using it smoothly. So you're always going to run into some things, like one of your participants has a bad internet connection today, or someone's kid is home from school and, you know, they have sort of a distractions, and that stresses them out trying to keep those things out of the background of their video conference or whatever. But you for sure have that visibility concern if you're at home too. So if you're a senior leader and you're not around a lot, then you might get left out of those informal conversations. And so people have expressed that concern over the couple of decades that we've really been studying this. One thing I'll say, and this is for in general, so it's not specific to the higher levels of leaders, but research has shown that promotability really is not affected by remote work. So that's some relief in terms of your career trajectory, but you really have to be super proactive about staying in touch and staying in the loop on the different decisions that are made. And I think, Chris, what you just said about decisions being made and conversations that to be had, the more you're around, the more you can be a part of that. There might be a point where it's not feasible for you to be at home, unless it's a like one day a week, uninterrupted day where you get to catch up on things that you need to focus on. You know, that might be a good use for it.
I mean, there's that water cooler talk that goes on, and there's a lot of company culture that sort of exchange that way. I'm just thinking back through our own experience in my office here. But the interesting thing, there's the other side of the paradigm, or, you know, the thing that I've always told my employees about working remotely. When we first talked about this, one of my operations officers was like, look, we can't do this. There's no way I can monitor what they're doing. What if they're not working? And all this kind of stuff. You know, he had a lot of, you know, reservations about that. And I remember having this conversation with, like, look, it's really about productivity. And I think that's for people that are working remotely, and then you were talking about the promotional aspects and things. Man, if you're a producer and you're able to show that in this remote work environment you can produce more than you normally would at your cubicle, you know, at said employee's office, you know, that type of thing, that's really what moves people ahead when they prove that when I'm away from here, how valuable they are. I think that's something that if anybody's working remotely right now, I would think that's important to make sure that you're super productive and you can show that productivity. And like you said, hyper communication, you know,
yes,
make sure everything's clear what you're communicating.
And I'll say, so there's definitely a caveat to that, to the conditions we're in right now, but I will totally agree with you that if you can communicate the ways that you're more productive or communicate your results in general, you know, I was able to accomplish X, Y, and Z today or this week or whatever, and usually it takes me longer to do that, that's great. And it's really up to the employee to communicate that when they talk with their boss and to be proactive about talking with their boss. So showing that this is going well and you can do this. And I've said this is a great opportunity for some people who have been wanting to work remotely for a while. This is kind of their opportunity to shine. But the caveat I will say is we have to consider the fact that we're all under a lot of stress. So the expectations that we have for ourselves might be too high. And really, as leaders, we have to consider that too. You know, consider the fact that your employee who is now working remotely for the first time also maybe is homeschooling their kids and has their partner at home with them also, and they feel the stress of the news and the news cycles and all that stuff.
Yeah, so lower the bar for maybe productivity in the next few weeks while we're trying to sort this out and get a groove on.
Yeah, I read there was a great article in the Chronicle of Higher Education this week about, it was directed at professors and academics, but it really applies to everyone, and how there is this transition of grief and almost survival mode that we are going through right now because there's so much uncertainty. So if we can acknowledge that and give ourselves a little bit of a break. I mean, we're going to try to work, and we need to do the things we have to get done during this time, but also recognize that you're not going to reach the highest goals you have set for yourself right now. You might not even be capable of that higher level thinking that you have to do to accomplish some of those things. So do the things you can do, and as we get into this new normal, we'll be able to get back into those things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, something that Dr. Curtis said reminded me of, like, and I think sometimes when, I know when I was transitioning into, you know, kind of being at a supervisor level, but being in a telework environment, I had to be creative on, you know, like Bill talked about his operations staff were concerned about being able to supervise or follow up with people. So I found that you had to be, just for your own warm fuzzy as a supervisor, you had to be more deliberate about, hey, you know, here's the five things that, you know, I expect you to do in this given period of time. So in some ways it's good because it makes things more measurable. Like it forces you to put goals that are, you know, tangible that you can check up on, because you can't just walk up to their cubicle and talk to them about progress checks. And in some cases, you know, like you talked about being conscientious. So if somebody is good at being on task when they're given, you know, clear guidance, it's good for them because you're not interrupting them all the time, asking them about, you know, how it's like, I can think about five different movies, you know, whether it be Office Space or Old School, you know, come to mind, where it's like, you know, the boss is always hovering around. It's like, you know, what's the status on that? He's like, well, I already finished that. That's the status on that, you know, and I'd do even more if you didn't get on my butt every time I was trying to do something. So, you know,
exactly.
if you know, who knows, this may be good for the micromanager types. You're kind of forced to, you know, cut the cord and, you know, trust people. So
I think that's a huge point. And that's one of the things that the meta-analyses that have been done on remote work, which is really the study of all the studies that have been done, has found the number one thing is autonomy. You have got to let people have autonomy if you're going to have them work remotely. You cannot micromanage from afar. And I know some people are trying to translate what they would do in person, their micromanagement from in person to remote, and it's not going to work. So just try to get creative about other ways to stay in touch.
Well, you know, and it reminds me, one of the things, I'm in the Marine Corps, so, I mean, we're recognized as kind of one of the world leaders on leadership, if that can be defined very well at all. But one of the things they always told us is, like, it's more effective, especially if you're talking about training for a combat environment, to tell people what to do, but not how to do it. You know, so you give them, like, you know, we would call it commander's intent. We say, you know, the whole big picture of what we're trying to do needs to feed up to this big idea, you know, and then let, you know, them wow you with the good parts or wow you with the not so good parts. But, you know, anytime you try to, unless you're, you know, there's certain very technical areas, you know, maybe you're in your background with computer programming could be example. I mean, there's just like ways to do things that, you know, have physical constraints, right? You may have a technical skill. But other than that, I mean, you know, I found that that's been true, you know, whether it was, you know, kind of in combat scenarios or just basic office. It's like, hey, these are the things we need to get done. And then, you know, you decide like how you best go about doing that versus like, you know, step one, you do this and then come back to me. And step two, you do that and then come back to me, because then you kind of sub-optimize the end state goal if you're kind of like managing the subtasks, I guess.
Exactly. And I think part of that too is trying to control the time. So what are you doing? Are you sitting at your computer from 8 to 5, are you sure that you're here on task giving us 100% of your effort? Well, in reality, nobody actually does that when they're at the office, because how many times do you have a conversation with someone that's just small talk or tangential? We have to realize that actually when we're working at home, the potential to maximize the time we are working and the output that we get is really high if we can get more uninterrupted time, which is one of the reasons people want to work remotely.
Yeah, you know, I was just thinking about the kind of a little bit of a transition to your background and the interest in stress, but think about all the commutes and the hours that are lost with, transition to the office, moving, going back and forth. I know when I work right now, I work remotely about 3 days a week currently. And quite frankly, it's nice because I'm at the farm. I don't have to make the 30-minute drive to the clinic. As long as my technology is in place, which is probably my bigger thing right now, because I'm battling with the, local IT, the local service providers, trying to make sure I've got the proper bandwidth and all that type of thing. Besides that, it's nice. If I'm like between patients or I'm between tasks, I can simply go and get myself a fresh coffee. And I can kind of be at my own pace inside the house, and boom, I'm back at work. I can make my own pace. It just feels socially more comfortable for me. And then I can kind of ramp up and dial in and do my visit. I can, my patient care visit. It's just, I just like that. And I think there's a lot less stress involved because you don't have to transition to the office, the commute, the gas, probably. I don't know. Have there been any studies that shows like more cost effective? I mean, if you look at,
Yes.
I probably am saving $500 a month in gas, just not driving back and forth to the office every day.
Yeah, there have been studies on various cost savings. I don't know the exact numbers, but even at a macro level, in terms of economics and environmental concerns or benefits, people have done studies on that showing that fewer people on the road equals less stress for the people that would have been on the road, and less stress for the people that are on the road still now with fewer cars, and all that time you save. One of the things I've been studying is the way people use the resources they have to maximize their well-being, and I think a huge part of that with remote work is using that extra time you have for your own goals in other domains of your life. So it could be your family goals, could be like, running your household and preparing for dinner and doing laundry. You can do those things on breaks where at work you would have been standing around having a small talk conversation with a colleague, which is good too. It serves its own purpose. But if you find that you're just overtaxed in terms of the demand you have in all the various domains of your life, working from home can really help you achieve some of that.
I was just right before we came onto this, I had just finished a podcast that I did with Dr. Ron Guevara, where we talked. I guess it was our COVID-19 update, and what we did is we just talked about the things people can do to boost their immunity and deal with stress and things like that. And one of the things I, have done when I've since I've been working at home more is, if I do two or three visits in a row, or a widget of work, if you will, for, 45 minutes, I'll get up and do some air squats. I'll go walk around, water something in the garden, kind of do some activities physically to move, which is, of course, better for health. And I also think if you're not commuting, you're not going back and forth, this might be the opportunity to get more sleep. Because we know, there's a lot of situations in the sort of work environment world right now where people don't sleep enough, which makes them sicker, which makes them have more health issues and cost companies more. And I'm sure that's a whole rabbit hole we could go down. But the reality of, how environmental stress for some employees in their regular workplace might be relieved by this, this new environment.
I've experienced that personally as well because I have been taking what I might have done for lunch, my lunch break, or just the time I might have spent getting ready for work and driving to work and driving home from work. And I've been walking every day for like an hour, which I never get in my normal life
Right.
when I'm going to the office.
That's
So that's
excellent.
been, yeah, lots of health benefits, self-care type benefits. And also, I was also talking to some friends. I've heard it from several now how people are enjoying the slower pace of their mornings, and that alone is good for your productivity the rest of the day. So you can choose to be intentional about those practices you want to put into your morning when you have that extra time. Part of it could be more sleep, and part of it could be more still, quiet time to start the day, or maybe it's exercise where you really set up your brain to be able to focus and be productive.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Do you think a lot of companies, once they experience maybe the good things about what this situation has forced on, do you think that some places will kind of never go back to the way they did things before? I mean, do you think?
In some ways, I hope that we all organizations and individuals learn something that improves the way we do business going forward. I have a feeling there's going to be a lot of organizations, depending on how long this goes, that just try to rush back to the way things were, and there's going to be a lot of backlash from that. So I think just in terms of the people that say, you know, I'm really going to miss this slow pace of the morning, it's going to be hard to get back into the normal way of doing work. I hope we don't see too much backlash in terms of people feeling disengaged and dissatisfied with their work now that they have to go back to an office once they've experienced home. I know people will enjoy the community they get back with being around people again.
Yeah, for sure. I can't believe I didn't think about this earlier, because I know I'm struggling with this right now with my team, but are there any, I know I've toyed around with different tools and telework collaboration resources. Like, have you in your research, or just heard word of mouth, like what are kind of the recognized, like, best online or VTC or teleconference collaboration tools that can facilitate some of this?
Yeah, the one I've heard everyone using lately is Zoom, and I know that there's some problems with, like, hackers in Zoom lately, so they've introduced this new waiting room feature. I think that's supposed to help you control access with who gets in, because apparently it's been pretty unpleasant, the stories I've heard of when the hackers get into your Zoom teleconference. Before this, we at Baylor use WebEx, and we also use Microsoft Teams, but we hadn't used a lot of those. So before all of this happened with my research teams, I was using Zoom to some extent, and just like FaceTime audio, FaceTime video. Mm-hmm. But then you have to have certain accounts, and everyone has to have certain technologies. So that's why Zoom has been so successful, I think.
Yeah, I've used Zoom both for work, and I actually just used it with my family. We have enough devices now where all of I have three kids, and so me and my wife, my three kids, were at the house all with a different device talking to their grandmother. And so it was like I'd used it for work, and I was like, well, I think I can set it up the same way for personal. And sure enough, so everybody had their either a phone or a laptop, and then we even got Granny on the horn. I said, hey, I'm gonna send you a link, and I just texted it to her, so she didn't have to, because you could do it via phone or email. And so I was like, well, I'll tell her, expect a text, this is when I'm gonna send it, and that way she would trust it. And sure enough, she was able to just click on it, and it opened up. And also Google Hangouts is one.
That's a good one.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it's kind of cool where these, like, very open platforms, and a lot of times these open platforms, because they have, high risk because of the name. I mean, if you can hack Google, or if you can hack Amazon, that, the military's even found out I can get on my Gmail from my government computer now, because, Google and Amazon, some of these companies, I mean, their security is trusted by the military. I mean, some of our most top secret information is now stored in Amazon and Google server farms.
Wow. Because,
yeah, that gives me a warm fuzzy, Chris.
Yeah. Maybe I shouldn't have said that, but AWS, like Amazon Web Services. Because you think about it, I have a lot of friends that work at Amazon. Amazon hires a lot of military people, but they talked about how Amazon never wanted to be limited, just like Google, on like bandwidth for their servers or storage space. And so early on, when they started getting, to have billions of dollars of capital, they just started investing in all this kind of excess capacity so that they could always grow and surge. And so a lot of times they sold it to companies or sold it to the military, saying, hey, this is going to be a secure way to store your stuff. But I think by the same token, stuff like Google Hangouts and things like that are very, they're smoothly run, they're secure, and they're harder to hack, because, mm-hmm. If you're Mr. Hacker out there and you can say you hacked Google Hangouts, I mean, that's like, your entire career right there. The FBI will probably hire you, like the Catch Me If You Can guy. If you can hack Google, you don't get arrested, you don't go to jail, you get hired by the FBI,
As a side note to the whole different apps and everything, I had heard somebody was on, I think it was on Facebook the other day, I guess everybody's been doing Zoom and they're doing all these different platforms. And somebody had the very embarrassing situation occur where they had a sidebar conversation with another attendee. And what they didn't realize is that the administrator of the system, I guess in this case it might have been a teacher, can see or hear, I guess, everything they're doing on the sidebar, or they get a transcript of it. So if you're a novice to these types of platforms, be careful how you communicate. Much like I always tell my kids on the internet, anything you put on the internet is there forever. Well, in a lot of these platforms, if you're working, you know, virtually and you're in a meeting and you think you're going to send some snarky response to somebody about the person talking, be aware that they may actually have access to the entire transcript. So you need to be really on the ball and say and keep everything professional and very guarded in those types of things, that you don't let loose comments or things that are inappropriate pass.
Absolutely. Good advice.
Yeah. It's like a hot mic moment.
Yeah, exactly.
So, hey, let's talk real quick. I know you're a professor at Baylor University. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think this is where we first met. We were both in that. There was a big, I guess you guys were having a competition.
Was it the negotiation competition?
Yeah. We were in the same judging panel there, I think.
That's right.
That's how we first met. But what's school like? I mean, my alma mater, Baylor University, is like nobody's on campus. It makes me sad. What's going on?
I know. It's really crazy for places like Baylor. We've always prided ourselves on the face-to-face, full and end-to-end experience.
Right.
In-person experience, and we have done some transitions to online in the past few years with some of our graduate programs, like our online MBA is really successful. But so we have some lessons learned and some good expertise on staff about online learning, but most of our faculty have not taught online unless they did before they came to Baylor. So it's been a really interesting transition. I think everyone's doing the best they can. we have a lot of really great resources and everyone's been super supportive, so that's good. But I know also our students did not sign up to have an online education, which no college student that's doing this right now signed up for these circumstances to try to do college. But for our Baylor students, they, you know, get a lot in the classroom and outside the classroom in extracurricular. So it is, it's been challenging, but I think we're all doing the best we can. And I know everyone does it slightly differently. So that's a little challenging for the students because they have all these different platforms and all these different ways of structuring the rest of the semester and all of that. It's a lot for the students to navigate.
I'm kind of interested, you know, I it must be very difficult for some of these maybe freshmen that decided, you know, they go off to college, woohoo, they're out of the house, and now they're in mom and dad's basement doing their homework. And I think that's going to be a pretty interesting transition. For what's the plan for Baylor? Are they just same as everybody else, wait and see, come back to campus, not come back to campus?
Yeah, we're out for the rest of the semester in terms of everything is online. And then we just got a notice literally right before this started, we started talking here, that summer school will all be online. As far as the conditions, if the conditions improve, the president said that we will add in face-to-face classes as well, but for now we're only scheduling online classes for the summer, which traditionally we had done online in the summer, so it's not as big of a change for us, because a lot of our students do go home for the summer, and so we've offered some online. So, but for the fall, we're still planning to everyone be there and be in person, and we're going to hope for the best and hope that we can do that.
My goodness.
Yeah. One of the things, just to transition a little bit, I know when I was LinkedIn stalking you before this interview, I saw some of your research topics and papers and articles, and you had something that it was interesting, because the more I read it, I was like, this might be fun to talk about, because I don't know if I actually agree with it, but it was about organized innovation research. So is that something that's been an ongoing project for you?
That's something that I worked on in graduate school, and we did a series of studies with engineering research centers that are funded by the National Science Foundation, and we studied their organizational planning processes and tools that they used. That was actually my thesis research, my master's thesis. And then we've done several papers on it, and then it all came together in a book. The head author of that is Dr. Steve Corral, who's now the president of University of South Florida. Mm-hmm. And that was really a project he had wanted to pursue kind of at that point in his career. So we all teamed up to do that, and it was a lot of fun, and the biggest thing for me that's come out of that in an ongoing capacity, I don't do research in that area heavily anymore. But I work with engineering professors to talk about how to integrate leadership and really leadership skills into engineering curriculum without offering a separate class that students have to self-select into. So a lot of the lessons that came out of that research inform that work I do.
Yeah, what I thought was interesting about it, I could see like certain fields, and that makes sense when you say like engineering, but I could see how, okay, if you're going to innovate, but you're in a very technical area, or if you're talking about physical science, you know, you have to kind of say, okay, how are we going to go about this methodically? But then there's some, you know, industries that there's been innovations where, you know, it's like you couldn't have really in a good way, in a structured way, organize that innovation to happen. It's like, I think you still have to depend on, you know, there's going to be geniuses, there's going to be people that, you know, are just outliers that can figure things out, and then, you know, you can organize around that. But I don't know, but that makes sense. Like, there's certain fields that probably you need, you know, some organized chaos, if you will, to make sure things get to a good end state. So.
Yeah, the way we agree with that there are those outliers and those genius moments. We actually addressed that in the book, but we came away with three general principles that had to do with, I guess, principles for thinking about the innovation enterprise and the process without controlling all the pieces. So there's still room for genius to happen, but there are these fundamental principles, and within each of those three pillars, we have like five or so specific tenets that people should consider as they're, I guess, organizing themselves as a research enterprise. So yeah, I agree with you there.
Yeah, I was lucky enough. I got to work on the Joint Strike Fighter program, you know, which is our new kind of fifth generation stealth fighter. So I got to go to Lockheed Martin and do a lot of work with them. And we actually had the first operational F-35 Joint Strike Fighter squadron that I supported. And so it was pretty fascinating to see, you know, you talk about a confluence of like some of the best aeronautical engineers in the world, pilots, military people, and just innovation, you know. So it's like they have a whole team that started, I think, probably back in the 60s called Skunk Works. And there's some pretty good books and movies that talk about, you know, the development of the B-2 stealth bomber and all these things. And so I think I got to see, like, you know, just a little inkling. I don't work there, but, you know, being from the outside looking in, talking to some of their engineers and pilots, it was pretty cool to see how, you know, it actually reminded me a lot of it when I saw that in your bio on LinkedIn, you know, just about organized innovation. Because you think about, you know, somebody like the military comes to you with a concept, say, hey, we want a plane that can do all this stuff. Oh, and by the way, it's invisible, you know, to radar. It's like how do you go about, like, you know, obviously, you know, some of these programs are literally $1 trillion in the case of the Joint Strike Fighter. So when you have that much money, you can hire all the MIT and, you know, everybody else that is an expert. But it's kind of cool that somebody still has to put it together. You know, you have to have some technical leadership, you know, in that innovation world to make it all, you know, be delivered on time. So
absolutely.
Yeah. So
I actually am. And as a further sidebar on that, my family is really into aviation. So I think my husband has watched most of the documentaries on any of that. He actually built an airplane, an RV-10.
Oh, cool.
And so even the innovation that had to happen as part of that is pretty fascinating, because it's not like they give you step-by-step directions and all the things you need. You really have to create things along the way, and it's really a team of other people around the world who build RV-10s in this case that can help lend insight into it. And that's all just hobby, you know. These people are just doing it as a hobby. But fascinating brains behind those types of projects.
Yeah, cool.
Kind of running down that rabbit hole where you talked about, you know, how science is – basically you're talking about science impacting business, and you're making you're trying to build platforms where you can structure the development of innovation. You can build the structure for that. That's happening a lot in medicine. I don't know if many of my colleagues are looking at that specifically, but one of the things I'm noticing is that – as the years have gone on, there's, you know, we're all taught things that are supposed to be facts in medical school. You know, like, oh, you know, the human body works this way, this disease does this, you should treat it this way. But then what happens is, and I've learned this over the years, there's a lot of medical lore. There's a lot of things that have absolutely no evidence that they're true at all. But you can ask 9 out of 10 doctors and they'll go, yes, you know, it's a little known fact. You know, like Cliff Clavin from Cheers, you know, just sitting there spouting off facts. And the reality is like, do you have any evidence to support that? And what's funny, or it's not funny, but what's interesting is science is starting to move more and more and more to this place where there's structured evidence. In other words, at the point of decision making, a doctor can say, well, that looks like a, you know, a child has an otitis media, you know, ear infection or a sore throat, and I'm just going to throw an antibiotic at it. And it's like, actually, sir, the research shows, and there'll be like a little blurb right there in our EMR system, our electronic record system, that says the evidence says this right now.
Wow, that's great.
And that's, yeah, and it's kind of a cool thing because what's starting to happen is it's starting to shape. If you're looking for it and you're receptive to it, that's the thing, is you have to be receptive to this idea. Then what happens is over time you're starting to shape like, oh, this is the way we do this now, because the research, you know, it may fly completely in the face of the lore that we were taught in medical school. But I see that as structured, you know, homogenizing of the medical knowledge that we have, and it's a big task. It ain't anywhere near where it should be. I can tell you there's 1,000 things that get done every day in medicine that are just totally based on hunch, based on, you know, reflex. And, you know, even with the COVID-19 thing right now, you know, it's really tricky what to do, and we're right at that cutting edge, and what we're having to do is decide what makes sense according to what we know and what doesn't make sense, and then you have to disseminate that to everyone. And I just think that whole process of trying to put structure to what we know and to build new processes that are become an algorithm that everyone should follow, because there's been lots of studies in medicine that show If there's a series of facts that are true, if doctors will all treat that the same way, the outcomes are better. You know, but yet we get this, you know, we get this wide ranging. I review a lot of charts, and I can tell you that reviewing the charts of other doctors, there's such a wide variety of what they will or won't do for any given patient. That I think that's you know, that's for all fields. Not, I mean, obviously engineering's one where if you could structure that learning, structure the process, yes, you're going to have the brilliant outlier things that occur, but if you can structure that, you're going to make progress steadily over time. And medicine's no different. It has to proceed that way.
Yeah, the way we actually talk about that in organized innovation is we talk about a focus on platforms versus product. And I think what you're talking about, this underlying process of decision making and the process of having the certain types of information to make decisions, you can redirect as needed. So we talk about platforms like the underlying operating system versus the specific application of, or the specific thing you develop from the operating system. So the more innovation, I guess you can be more innovative by focusing first on platform, and then it can be adapted lots of different ways. Like we're seeing all these people retool their assembly lines and the equipment they have to do things that we need for COVID-19. And that's an example of platform versus product. So we can do lots of products if we have the platforms right.
It's the process. Chris, what's the coach's name that you're always quoting, the NFL guy that always talks about the process? That's his whole thing.
Oh, like Bill Belichick.
Yeah. Same thing. It's like they constantly preach the idea of we must, if you have the proper process, then the result will come. You don't have to have the result necessarily in mind.
One of the newest NFL coaches, Matt Rhule, is all about the process now at the Carolina Panthers, formerly at Baylor University.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, the hard thing about it, human nature, it's hard to do, though. You know, it's like they also call, it's like watching the game versus watching the scoreboard, because everybody wants to see if you're, you know, ahead or behind. And that's really hard to do, because you always want to say, you know, constantly gauge and measure how you're doing. But a lot of the most successful people in a lot of fields are like, hey, you know, this is a sound process. You know, and in medicine, sometimes it's punitive. I know there was a book we've talked about before, David versus Goliath by Malcolm Gladwell, where he talked about some of the most successful people in cancer research and other things. I mean, they had to kill a lot of people, honestly, doing some of this research, but they were saying, hey, I know this is the right path to go on. And that's really hard to do, because as humans, we want to see results quicker, you know, not just the process.
Yeah, I think that applies to what we're seeing right now with everyone's trying to figure it out. Like Dr. Yeah. Curtis said, right on the cutting edge of trying to figure it out.
Yeah, for sure. Hey, so tell us where you're at research-wise now. I know you've had background working with the study of stress. Is that specifically with employee-related stress, or is that general stress?
Yeah, I look at stress involving employees specifically, but I look at it across the boundary of work and family, or work and non-work. And so we have a study right now that we already were running the study actually on remote work and stress and the work-family dynamic, and we're looking at couples. So we're actually surveying the employee and their spouse or partner, and we're looking at perceptions of how remote work affects that dynamic in addition to the employee and the attitudes they have about work and the productivity they feel they have in various places and that sort of thing. So we were already running this study, and then COVID-19 happened. So we have a sample, a small sample already of 99 people who have completed the study, and we've redirected our efforts to focus this, since we already had all the measures and IRB and all those things we have to do in academia, everything was already going. So we are now studying people's work-family dynamic and overall well-being, in terms of being an employee and overall psychological well-being. And we're doing that in this context. So we're collecting people, or, you know, collecting participants who either are brand new to remote work or have been working remotely before this. And we're trying to get sort of an even sample, about 300 of each, so that we can compare. How does a veteran remote worker do things, and how are they affected in these times versus how a new remote worker might handle these situations we're in right now?
Dr. Perry, is that a set of, what is it, like questionnaires? Or
yeah, online surveys. Employee is filling out two online surveys across 4 weeks. So they every Monday we send out to the next session or next batch of participants, where they fill out one online survey, and then in 4 weeks we're following up with them, and we're seeing some of those measures are repeated, so they'll answer the same questions, but others are different questions that we're trying to assess sort of outcomes out of this period of time. And then the spouse completes one online survey.
Interesting. So we need to blow that up, Chris. And is there like a link or something? How do people sign
up
for that?
Yes, the link is to sign up for it is tinyurl.com/Baylor Remote Work Study. And so I can give you that link to put in the notes too.
Yeah, I'll definitely do that. Yeah.
I don't know if I want my spouse voting on things, but that's
you'll never know what your spouse said. They'll never know what you said.
It's like he's working at home and he's using all the toilet paper. What's going on?
I should also note that it doesn't have to be 100% remote work, but in these times I know a lot of people are 100% remote work, but that's not a criteria.
My gosh, maybe you guys could scale that up. I mean, seems like, I don't know. What do you think the transition numbers are right now? Because, I mean, there's got to be tens of thousands of people doing that.
More than that, probably. And we have had a lot of success. I mean, we've basically just been recruiting on LinkedIn and Facebook and Reddit and through our personal network. So we're probably to 600 by now that we've collected, but we don't expect all of them will follow through because that's just human nature.
Right.
So we have to collect more than 600 to try to get 600 in the end. So, but we're paying people with a $25 Amazon gift card, so we do have an incentive for doing it, which also means in the world of social science research, that means you get a lot of people that aren't really who they say they are, and they try to fill it out multiple times. So there's always the fraud checking we have to do as part of that.
Well, yeah. I was going to say this interview may help, because our last interview we did I think we had like 400 downloads in the first few days, so maybe we'll help get your word out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hope so.
I mean, I think a lot of people will be interested in this topic for sure. Kind of a couple, we've covered a lot of the work remote. What do you think, what industries do you think are going to be most affected or are most affected by this whole quarantine COVID-19 situation? How do you think it's going to impact which industries the most? Do you have any feel for that? I think the teaching is the one I think is.
Yeah, that's the first one I was going to say. Teaching, I think we're learning a lot about what we can do remotely. I don't know that I see public schools going online by any means, but figuring out how we can use technology in effective ways to teach our students and having them be a little more self-directed and how that fits into a larger education system. I don't know how that might look, but I definitely see education will be impacted. And I'm seeing our teachers, you know, it's not an easy job for especially elementary teachers to try to teach remotely. I mean, an online class to first graders, which is one of my daughter's in first grade, that's not the easiest thing to do, but I'm seeing their teachers are just rising up and doing an awesome job. So yeah. I think there's a lot to learn, and hopefully it'll impact education for the better. I think we're also going to see that there are a lot of jobs that could very easily be remote jobs, but it's really a matter of organizational preference, personal preference, boss preference, those sorts of things.
Hey, Dr. Perry, did you, maybe we talked about this at some point in the distant past when we first met, but do you ever read Tim Ferriss's book, The 4-Hour Workweek?
Yes, I have.
So I don't know. I don't know. I'm not an expert in your field, but I don't know if that was a seminal work on remote working. But that book infected my brain way back when it was first written. And from the time, I was already a physician at the time, and I was like, well, I'm in this field where I have to see people eye to eye, and I have to do this and do that. And as a sidebar story here, about 8 years ago, I read that book. And I said, and Tim Ferriss wrote this book and, you know, had all things how to, you know, remote work, how to like outsource your entire life so you could just be where you want to be and make an income. So it really appealed to me at the time. I think I was a burnout resident or something at the time. It was really appealing. So anyway, I kind of went down that rabbit hole. And actually at one point, I mean, I'm shoestringing platforms together that were never meant to do this, you know, Skype and all kinds of stuff. And it was, I actually went and worked for 6 weeks in Sligo, Ireland. And what I did is I set my office up with a big, I'm sitting in the room right now where I normally do this. And I have a big screen in there with a camera, and we've gotten more sophisticated. But basically I was seeing patients remotely like 8 years ago. And I love the idea that I could be where I wanted to be, which was with my family 10 time zones away, doing what we wanted to do all day. But then I could work 6 hours in the evening. They're all going to bed and everything, and I'm popping in and I'm seeing patients in time, you know, Central Standard Time, and the patients thought it was cool, it was innovative, and some of them were able to be at home, some of them came to the clinic and got their blood work. Anyway, my point of that whole story is that I think there's a lot of ways that this is going to change and open people's lives. There's a lot of ways it could change completely how we work. I know our office with infectious disease in particular, I'm not sure we'll ever go back. Like prior to the actual quarantines, we had actually, as a clinic, decided we were not going to, we would not allow sick patients in the office. So what we did is we went 100% telemedicine. So if a patient called and said, oh, I've got a cough, I don't feel good, we would say, great, we'll set you up for a telemedicine visit. They get screened by the doctor. So we would do a whole visit. Sometimes we would just treat them. But as the cases, COVID-19 cases came into our community, which didn't happen, that only came up like last week. We had our first cases in our community. When that happened, then we started screening, but we wouldn't allow them in the clinic. We would have them come up to a special parking place, honk. They honk twice, and the nurse would come out in her spacesuit and swab their nose, and we go back in. And so we would call them later and say, hey, your COVID-19 is, excuse me, negative. I just think that there's a lot of things that aren't going to go back, or they will be different moving forward. I think I'll be very fascinated by that. I'm very future oriented. I'm constantly harping about automated cars and all these things that are going on. You know, people think you're going to be a truck driver forever, and you know all these kind of innovations that are occurring. It's coming. It's not going to reverse itself. There's going to be self-driving trucks. They're already doing it on the interstates between California and Arizona. So it's one of these things that's just, I think we're seeing something that's going to be a catalyst for change. The question is, you know, can we be flexible, adapt, and create better and better tools for doing so?
I just had a good idea, Doc. You could, you would get your own reality show. You could have like a little temperature chamber that if people walk in your office and it scans them, if they have a temperature, then a little chute opens up and it puts them on a slide and they can't go in your office. They just like, you know, they get jettisoned out like in a swirly slide and go back out to another area in the parking lot.
We prefer at our office the Willy Wonka scale.
Yeah, it's like, you can't come in. You have a temperature.
The bad egg. It's really strange times. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, so I was talking to a guy, Dr. Richard Clayton, who has done some stuff on I've seen some videos he's done with media. He's in Hong Kong. I think he's originally from Australia. So I had a conversation with him the other day about what he's witnessed. And he's an organizational psychologist that does consulting, and he's in the world of co-working, which is an interesting world in itself. But he was telling me, and he said this on several interviews, which is why I want to make sure I give him credit. He says he thinks, and his research and other research he's seen, says that people actually only have 2.5 hours of focused, productive work per day. And that we get interrupted every minute and a half, and it takes us about 30 minutes to get back into it fully. And so he was saying, you know, really the HR departments he's talking to right now in Hong Kong are seeing more productivity because there's less interruption. And I mean, he breaks it down also, and I think Tim Ferriss would kind of do the same thing, where there's this deep focused work, and that's really where you do your best work. But then there's also this formal collaboration type aspect of your work, and so we need other people to do that, and that's where the innovation and creativity come from. We don't probably need that every day, but that's going to happen. You have to make that happen somehow. Then there's this time of connection, which is more informal, and it's more about chat, small talk. And then there's learning, and then there's shallow work, like administrative, maybe like stuff you can do like going through your email or stuff that you don't have to put a lot of brain power into. And so his idea was, if we can get, and he tells people, if you can get 2.5 hours of focused work done per day, you're doing just as good as you would have done in a non-COVID world. And so, I don't know, he said that gives some people hope, and I think it kind of goes along with what Tim Ferriss found. You don't have to waste so much time. You can work less if you don't waste so much time.
Yeah, it's the, what is the name? I'll have to think of it. There's a... what's the work philosophy where you work for 45, you take 15 off? What do they call that?
Yeah, or 50-10 is where 50-10, what I hear it cited as a lot. Yeah,
yeah.
The 50-10 rule.
Yeah, those kind of things. I've played with all kinds of those, you know, ways of, you know, kind of blocking my time out. I'm excessively type A about things like that. But I'm definitely in believe that things are changing dramatically as we speak. So.
Well, another point along that, I was just listening to a podcast, and it was an interview with Andy Crouch, who does some work in the Christian ministry world with, I think, an organization named Praxis or something. He had an article that apparently went viral earlier this week on to prepare past the blizzard. So the analogy he used was, we can't think of this as a snow day. We have to think of this as a season, like it's winter, not just a blizzard. And we have to learn from it. And really, it's going to affect our lives for the next year to 2 years to beyond. And if we can learn some things during this and really plan for the future in a way that we know that we are going to change from this, we can't just go back to the way we were, because none of us will be the same. It was an interesting perspective, I thought.
Yeah, hashtag buy more toilet paper early on.
Keep a stock.
Just keep a stock, for sure.
Make a friend with an extreme couponer.
Exactly. Well, I guess we've been going at it about an hour. I think we've covered some great areas and insights. Most importantly, this seems like a conversation that is going to get people thinking. It's going to get people thinking about where they are. Just my organization, 70% of our employees right now are now working remotely. or coming in only part-time, you know, just because of how we've had to transition our, for infectious disease, you know, we rotate teams so that, you know, that not everyone's in the clinic if somebody does happen to walk in and infect everybody kind of thing. So it's I think this is going to really enlighten people and hopefully give them a different way of looking at this, you know, instead of just a temporary thing, it may be something more long-term or something that they integrate in the future. Chris, any final thoughts before we let Dr. Perry wrap up?
Not really. I just, like you were saying, Doc, I hope this gets people thinking that I know a lot of people have had problems with their, you know, keeping a positive headspace about all this, but I think knowing that, you know, there's some data that shows you can still be productive, get promoted, you know, as an aggregate is a good thing. And hopefully if you have families, it causes you to, you know, soak up some family time that you wouldn't, I guess, forced family time that, you know, you would have wanted, you know, I guess, take all things as a positive as much as you can. So,
yeah. Dr. Perry, any final thoughts for the humans out there listening to us and maybe kind of impacted by this whole remote working situation?
I guess one thing I'll say is we need to think about what are our expectations for ourselves right now, and are they realistic? And a lot of people have been coming out, a lot of scholars have been saying we need to realize that we actually have grief and we are in survival mode. And so we have to go through those and acknowledge those emotions and that stage. We have to go through those. We can't just skip them. So we're not going to come home and be 100% productive. We're working from home, trying to prove ourselves working from home right now. But we have to also try to set up the boundaries in terms of our schedule and our time, and try to be intentional with how we're spending our days so that we will get there and we will be able to engage in that higher order learning and thinking soon, and hopefully we'll learn some new routines from it. So we have to figure out how to spend time working and spend time resting and spend time sleeping, and really intentionally turning off the work at the end of the day is one of the big keys to doing that. So figure out how we can take care of ourselves on our breaks and at the beginning and the end of the day so that we don't become overstressed because of our work in addition to all the things going on in the world.
That's smart and structure, and I appreciate you being on. I think this was a great interview. Dr. Sarah Perry, we appreciate you joining us with the WFL Life podcast. If you ever have anything that you're interested in sharing with us or new insights, you know how to reach me. Definitely, you're always welcome. And we'll definitely put a link. I'll make sure when we're off to capture that, make sure I've got that website for the research you're doing. I think that'd be great if everybody could jump on there and, you know, pump the numbers up. Anytime you have more numbers, it generally is a good thing.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks again.
Thanks a lot.